Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 24th, 2006. Our session today is entitled, Why Does God Wrestle with Jacob Rather Than Hold a Conversation? Our presenter is Richard Prigge, session number PRR 2006-04. Let's listen in.
God be with you.
And you.
Let us pray. Loving God, there are some times in our lives and in our experience with you when we do feel a bit like Jacob, like you've kind of sprung upon us in the night, maybe at a especially fearful time for us, and that we've just had a period of really wrestling with ourselves and with you, and we would want to take away from Jacob's story this morning that there's a blessing at the end of that struggle. That we know that you mean us good and mean us well, and that you mean growth for us, that you mean reconciliation for us with one another. And so even this morning, as we wrestle with this story that is so multifaceted, we pray that you'd somehow bring us in the end to a blessing from all this, that we might grow closer to you and to one another. All this we pray in confidence in Jesus' name.
Amen.
All right then. So today, I think we come to the climax of Jacob's story. It's not the end of the story. And actually, that will be important when we'll deal with that tomorrow. Why this very, very dramatic story is not the end of the story. There's actually more to the story. But this is, I think, pretty obviously the climax of the story. The wrestling match of Jacob in the night. But before we get that, I want to take just a brief glance backward at yesterday's part of the story. Remember that we started yesterday with Jacob alone for the first time, after his mother in particular has played such a formative role in his spiritual development. Now Jacob has to go it alone, and you'll remember that he is going to encounter three experiences which John Sanford, the commentator, I think brilliantly identifies as three experiences designed to break down his egocentricity and lead him to God. And those three experiences are suffering. He does not get his way for the first time. An encounter with a will greater than his own. Okay, he encounters God personally for the first time in this dream. And he even speaks the name God for the first time. And the third experience that will make you less egocentric is coming to care for someone other than yourself. And that happens in by falling in love with Rachel and being willing to work 14 years for her. Now, you know, we didn't... I don't think we lingered long enough yesterday on this, the part about Jacob being willing to work 14 years for Rachel. Is that speaking to you at all? Does that have anything, is that resonating at all with your experience?
Sure, it's contrary to immediate gratification.
Have you experienced that in your life?
Oh, yes. I think most of us have.
That you have to work for something that is good?
Sure. Especially if I upset my wife.
I'm still in my 14-year process trying to get over it. Fix that one.
All right.
But you're talking about his great love for Rachel, and he's willing to work for 14 years, but he's also willing to leave Leah just hanging there as a, you know, as a lost object.
Right. So what
Which
happens
really
to
sad.
Leah?
Yeah.
What happens to Leah? It is sad.
It's really
That's
sad.
Right. Mm-hmm. So what, is there any salvation for Leah?
Well, Leah has all these children.
Yeah.
So she's very busy.
Right. God visits Leah and blesses her. But now that's
but
not to take away the...
No, because she really, she keeps saying every time she has a child, now my husband will love me, respect me, pay attention to me, and nothing ever, she's glad that she's having the children, but she never gets the love she wants.
Mm-hmm.
So she is this lost person.
Yeah, I think
her children
you're right.
Are wonderful.
There's really pathos in that. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Hurt. Yeah. Yes.
I can't see myself working 14 years for anything.
No.
I'm just so used to immediate gratification.
Yeah, having to wait 14 years for the fruit of your labor, that does seem...
Well, but he didn't wait 14 years.
Okay, he waited 7.
He thought he was going to do... His gratification wasn't 7. And then
right.
He just had to work for
Right.
I think one thing that shows through is Jacob's honor for the second 7 years. Because he would not have to have honor that. He could have taken and gone, but he said, yes, I'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said that starts to show his character through and his changing.
Mm-hmm.
In this narrative, too, I think it was just so important that Leah actually takes a place of prominence here because she reclaims the birthright of the firstborn that Jacob took away.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about that yesterday when Laban said, in this country, here's what we do with the firstborn. I cannot marry my daughter, the secondborn. And so he being the one who took away the birthright from his eldest brother, she actually vindicates that in the narrative
yes.
of the firstborn. I think that's very striking, too,
mm-hmm.
that he learns that.
Mm-hmm.
It also seems like it's a good thing that Leah didn't get the love of her husband as a result of childbearing, because what sort of model does that lead to? A system of women as childbearers, that's your worth, and you can get validation by having kids. If that's the biblical model, then we're in trouble. The blessing of Leah comes in some other forms.
But that was her validation.
But it never got the love of her husband.
No, never.
And if it had gotten the love of her husband, that would set a very dangerous precedent for...
Guess what? For a long, long time, that was how women got their validation, by having children.
Yeah.
That was the value of women.
Mm-hmm.
And was that godly validation? I mean, was that...
No, society. The church, certainly.
Well, and the Jewish...
It says, when the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, he opened her womb.
Yeah.
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 So it's more about God saying, you know, you're bearing the lack of the love of your husband, so therefore I'm going to bless you.
The validation, the grace of God shows up then in the relationship between God and Leah.
Yeah.
Not between Leah and Jacob.
Right.
Leah never gets to realize that love with Jacob,
right.
but does get to realize it with God.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. It's a different blessing.
Yeah.
It's a different blessing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How much of that blessing may not be due in part to not having a social security system? The children were the ones who would provide for you in your old age if you don't have any.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, and of course these are not just any children who are born here.
Right.
We're going to get to that in just a moment. That's very important.
Can I, just one thing though, but what it does do is to say that the blessing of a woman comes through the birth of children. That God's blessing comes by having children.
That leads to...
And so that has been what's validated women. And women who didn't have children were somehow second class citizens.
Well, okay, that's very interesting. I think what I'm hearing you say is there's really two different blessings here. There's a blessing of Rachel through the love of Jacob.
Right.
and a blessing of Leah through bearing children.
Right.
Those are different blessings. Both are blessed differently.
But then that leaves the woman who never married or had children as somehow unblessed.
Lacking.
Yes.
Society does that today. People, single men.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. They're outcasts.
Right. Or at least to be pitied.
And again, you can't really blame Jacob for the whole thing. I mean, Jacob wanted Rachel to begin with, and he, you know, Leah was sort of forced on him, and so it was, you know, again, a societal thing rather than his desire.
You often wonder, too, they live in a society where he was allowed more than one wife.
Yes.
Yeah. Now,
had he lived in our society where you can only have one wife,
one at a time.
Would you want more than one?
He'd have been waiting a lot longer for Rachel.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Well, this linkage of romance and work, I want to return to it. It's just, I think, very important, and a message which the community of faith has to bear to the society that is still is pretty countercultural today. I had a 2-year-long training course in marriage counseling in the mid-1990s when I was a parish pastor. It was one of the most helpful experiences that I've had in my ministry. And the person who taught the course, by the name of Harvel Hendricks, H-E-N-D-R-I-X, he's written a books that are kind of bestsellers. His perspective was very strongly that when you have, quote, fallen out of love with your mate, okay, the way to proceed is by, to put it in this vocabulary, working on behalf of or for your mate, whether you feel like it or not. Okay? In other words, so a couple comes in to the counselor and says, I've lost all feeling for my husband or my wife. I do not love her anymore. I feel nothing for her at all. The prescription for that, and now I'm kind of oversimplifying, but I think it's worth doing that anyway. The prescription is for the husband, if he's lost feeling for his wife, to make a list of those behaviors that he could do that would be 100% assured of being received as caring behaviors by the wife, and simply to do one a day, you know, or two a day, whether he feels like it or not. In fact, it would be 100% assured at the beginning that he wouldn't feel like doing it. After all, he's fallen out of love, right? He has no feeling. Rather than, you know, the opposite way would be to try to find some ways to stir up his feeling for her. See, it's Harvel Hendricks' view that that doesn't work. That the way to proceed is by behaving lovingly first. And then with a promise or a hope that the feeling would return. Very interesting. And I think that really that this story is telling us there's something to that. That love and work always go together. The feeling and behavior are linked. We're going to move on from that, and I'm just going to tell you now how the story proceeds in a few chapters that are between the marriage here of Jacob and Rachel and the setup for his meeting again with Esau. First of all, there are 10 sons born. Okay, and they're up here on the board, except the Rachel's got left out here. The Rachel's sons are, of course, Joseph and Benjamin. Benjamin is born quite a bit later, on the way back home. And does anyone know that story of the birth of Benjamin? What happens there? Rachel dies. Rachel dies in childbirth. So that is a very poignant and sad, bittersweet moment, obviously. The birth of the second child to Rachel and Jacob, but Rachel's death at the same time. And of the 12 sons, two of them are clearly going to be the most important in the furtherance of the story. The one whose story is told at length right after Jacob's story is
Joseph.
Joseph. The first child of Rachel, Jacob's beloved wife. But the other son, who becomes very, very important in the story of the people of Israel, is
Judah.
Judah, because it is from the family lineage of Judah that David is born. And we want to linger for just a moment that whose son was Judah?
Leah's
son.
And these are the 12 tribes
of Israel. These are the 12 tribes of Israel. So the history of this people is going to be carried forward by 12 tribes that are named by the 12 sons of Jacob. And so now you might say here the narrator of the story has a chance to tell about the great beginnings of the people of Israel here now. The 12 tribes, these are the 12 ancestors, you know, of the 12 tribes. Is this a grand and glorious beginning that we're telling here? It's a great,
No.
It's a bunch of conflict again.
Yeah.
And struggle.
Was Judah the oldest?
No, Judah was the fourth. Reuben is the oldest. Yeah, Judah is the fourth. So all middle children now, take heart from yes.
It's not just being blessed with bearing children, it's being blessed with the responsibility of raising up future generations.
Ah.
Yeah.
Very good. There you go. Absolutely. So the children are born. Then there is quite a period of what I would call mutual trickery between Laban and Jacob for the preeminent place in terms of the number of cattle. Laban first tricks Jacob out of his cattle, and then Jacob one-ups him by tricking him even more. Tricking Laban even more on more cattle. And then in the beginning of chapter 31, God tells Jacob, it's time to go back home. And this is Genesis 31, verse 3. Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your ancestors and to your kindred, and I will be with you. So in response to what he believes is God's command, Jacob packs up and heads home. But he packs up secretly. Because he's still, you know, Laban is still this tricky uncle here that at any moment might cause something bad to happen. So he packs up secretly and gets a few days head start on Laban before Laban figures out that, wow, I mean, Jacob is gone, his daughters are gone, all the cattle are gone, and Laban then beats a path out of there and catches up with him. And I want you to notice one, there's a great deal of humor in Jacob's story at several places, and here is a humorous spot. One of the things that has happened is that Rachel has made off with the family gods. Now, Laban's family, like Abraham's, were worshippers of Yahweh. So what is this business about the household gods? And I always compare this to some years ago, we visited Norway. My mother's family is Norwegian. And we visited the stave churches. I don't know whether any of you have seen these real, real old stave churches. And the stave churches happened at a period in Norway's history where they were converting to Christianity. So it was right at the beginning. And the stave churches, if you know this, they have a big cross at the top, and then down the eaves are all these dragons. So it's kind of like they're saying, yeah, you know, I think we're going to convert to Christianity, but there may still be something about this
just
pagan dragon. So just in case.
Keep all the bases.
Yeah, that's right. Cover all the bases.
All bases.
Yeah. That's right. Right. So, So Rachel's going to make off with these household gods, you know, just in case there might be something to them. And knowing that they...
This translation, Rich, says, Rachel stole her father's family idols.
Oh, okay.
Family idols.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. The kind of good luck charms.
Yeah.
Yeah, made off of. And so so Laban comes, and he catches up with Jacob's party, and he's very just indignant about the fact that Jacob would have had to steal off, kind of, you know, sneak away, and also that they have stolen the family idols. We'll put it in that way. So he goes searching, and so Jacob said, well, you come on, we didn't do that. You go searching for him. Go through all the tents here and you just see if you can find him. Well, Rachel's got him. And where has she got him? She's sitting on him underneath the saddle. Okay? So, and Rachel, you see, a little bit of Jacob has rubbed off, or her father, too, have rubbed off on Rachel, because this is one of the few times when we actually find out something about Rachel. I mean, she's really not a very rich character in this story. So if someone would be willing to read, please, while the rest of us follow along, Genesis 31, verses 33 through 35. Verses 33 through 35. We'll find out a little bit about Rachel. Go ahead.
So Laban went into Jacob's tent and into Leah's tent and into the tent of the two maidservants, but he found nothing. After he came out of Leah's tent, he entered Rachel's tent. Now Rachel had taken the household gods and put them inside her camel saddle and was sitting on them. Laban searched through everything in the tent but found nothing. Rachel said to her father, "Don't be angry, my lord, that I cannot stand up in your presence. I'm having my period." So he searched and could not find the household god.
Pretty clever, is it?
She knew that was a no-no.
That's right. Her father would just back away from that. So Laban never did find his household gods. Never found them. In fact, there was Laban and Jacob made a kind of truce. And Laban kisses his daughters and his grandchildren and heads on back home. And so Jacob, after 20 years with his uncle in his ancestral home, is now back on the doorstep of where he grew up, ready to meet his brother again. Okay, and so we're at chapter 32. I forgot one thing that I wanted to mention, and I think I'm going to mention it right now. After the session yesterday, Clara, a young woman who's sitting right back here, Clara has done a lot of study of ancient and modern Jewish practice, and she said that she was at an Orthodox Jewish wedding earlier this summer, and now, so this is today's modern Orthodox Jewish wedding service. What happens is that the bride comes in, you know, to meet the groom, and the very first thing that happens is that the groom makes a very careful inspection of the bride's face. Gets real. I don't know if any of you have ever been to an Orthodox.
I just heard someone explain because her daughter was getting married.
Okay.
So she was talking.
So almost sounds humorous to me, but the groom literally gets up real close, you know, and has to, you know, really look, you know, to see, you know, is this the woman that I really want to marry here? And also, Clara said that the woman may not wear makeup, okay, because that would be a possible, quote, disguise. And only then, and after the groom has verified that, yes, in fact, this is the woman that I want to marry, then he, the groom, takes the veil and puts it over her face, and the wedding begins, essentially. And Clara said this is a direct response to the story of Jacob and Leah. That we want to be, we don't, in a sense, we don't want to repeat the hurt that happened between Jacob and Leah. We want to be sure this is really the loved one. Isn't that, that's just stunning.
Yeah.
You hear people all the time, you're not the person I married.
That's right. To which the groom in this case could say, oh, yes, you are. Yes, I am. Yeah. Okay, well, that's a little bit of a parenthesis. Now we're on to chapter 32. And I need four readers here. We're going to read verses 3 through 21. Who are four readers? Okay, there's one. Verses 3 through 5. Okay, verses 6 through 8. Okay, Kristen, how about 9 through 12? Have we got a fourth reader then? Okay, Chuck, we'll give you 13 through 21. Okay, and we'll just read right on through, and then we'll ask what strikes you.
Jacob sent messengers before him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom, instructing them, "Thus you shall say to my lord Isaac, to my lord Esau," I'm sorry, my glasses are weird here, "Thus says your servant Jacob, I have lived with Laban as an alien and stayed until now, and I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, male and female slaves, and I have sent them, my lord, in order that I may find favor in your sight."
And the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and he is coming to meet you, and 400 men with him." Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that were with him, and the flocks and herds and camels, into two companies, thinking, "If Esau comes to the one company and destroys it, then the company which is left will escape."
And Jacob said, "O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, 'Return to your country and to your kindred, and I will do you good,' I am not worthy of the least of all the steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, please, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I am afraid of him. He may come and kill us all, the mothers with the children. Yet you have said, 'I will surely do you good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted because of their number.'"
He stayed there that night, then prepared a present for his brother Esau from what he had, 200 she-goats and 20 he-goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milk camels with their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. He had the servants take charge of them, putting each drove by itself. "Go on ahead of me," he told his servants, "and keep a distance between each drove and the next." He ordered the first man, "When my brother Esau meets you and asks you, 'Whose man are you? Where are you going? And whose animals are these ahead of you?' Then say, 'Your servant Jacob's. They are a present sent to my lord Esau, and he himself is behind us.'" He gave the same orders to the second man, the third, and all the others who followed their droves. "Tell Esau that," he said, "when you meet him, and say also, 'Your servant Jacob is behind us.'" He thought, "I'll make him friendly by giving him a present that goes ahead of me, and then I'll see his face, maybe he'll welcome me." The presents went on ahead of him while he stayed in the caravan that night.
Okay, what strikes you here in this story?
Mine is the fact that when he prayed, he reminded God. He wanted to be sure that God remembered that he had promised him.
Okay. Very important. Can we look at this prayer in verses 9 through 12? What would you observe about the prayer? The first observation is that he ends by reminding God in verse 12. You know, you've said that I'm going to do you good here and make your offspring as the sand of the sea. The implication is, better come through here, God.
You promised.
Yeah, you promised.
Yeah, I'm unworthy, but you did promise.
Right. Mm-hmm. There's a great story about Martin Luther that was told by his wife, Catherine von Bora. Maybe some of you have heard this. Katie said that when Luther was at prayer, you know, and she observed him, he was just so intense that it was, she said, as if Luther had grabbed God by the beard and said, "But you have promised." But you have promised. And that's kind of what Jacob is doing here. Now, you know, don't forget your promise. Holding God to God's promise.
Well, he opens the prayer also by saying, "You're the one that's sending me on. I'm not doing this of my own will."
Okay.
And even before that, isn't the reminder, "O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac"? Mm-hmm. He starts right out with saying, you know, you're connected with this family. Yeah.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Isn't that essentially also reminding God?
Yeah, and he says, "I also left with nothing but a walking stick, and look at all the good stuff I've done. I'm now two companies."
Isn't that, that's a pretty dramatic reference. I had only a staff when I crossed the Jordan. Now I'm going back over the Jordan with two full companies. Can you say a little?
Yeah. Were you going to say something?
Oh, I was just thinking that, aren't we like that today? We say, "Oh Lord, you're my Father, you're wonderful, you're majestic," and then when it comes to something to really trust Him, we kind of pull Him by the beard and really want what we should have known all along. I mean, they're just no different than we are today.
I think it's easy to get cynical about this prayer, but at the same time, I think it's actually the heart of Scripture. This is where it comes down to. I mean, Leah might want to please her husband by having kids, but it's about relationship with God. Jacob may want to appease his brother, but in the end, it comes down to trusting God, following God, and if God isn't for me, if I'm not following in Jesus' footsteps, it doesn't matter how much luck or success I have. There's nothing. It's the God of my fathers, the God of my mother.
Okay.
It's also like he's saying, "Okay, buddy, God, we're in this together."
Right.
Is exactly what God finally wanted Jacob to be.
Yeah.
All of this is leading up to right here where Jacob said, "Oh, this is what you mean. All right, I'm with you. I'm in."
But what about this egocentricity trip? The suffering, acknowledgement of God, and then doing for others. The third element. I don't see the third element yet.
Do we see anything now? Let's look also. Let's continue to look at this prayer. Is there anything in here other than, you know, a struggle to trust the promise that God has made?
There's a sense of, "Yet you have said, I will surely do you good." So Jacob seems to be naming Jacob's purpose to serve God. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of gets beyond Jacob, what Jacob's will is, but more what God's will is?
Okay.
If I'm reading that right now. Mm-hmm.
Well, Jacob is also hoping God will protect him from Esau.
Yeah. Well, yeah. There's a real challenge to trust here. Those 400 men that are coming with Esau. But what do you think about this? I mean, are you cynical about what Jacob prays in verse 10? "I am not worthy of the least of all the steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown your servant." I mean, is this just kind of a throwaway line here from Jacob?
There's some humility there.
Yeah, I think it's genuine.
Well, to me, how did he get the blessing that gave him all the good that's been showered upon him? I think he's seeing some of that.
He's giving the credit to God. He's not saying, look what I did.
I think he is. Unless we're just out and out cynical about what he's saying. I think he's pretty plainly saying...
He's buttering
God. Okay, yeah, is he buttering God up here? I mean, that we have to take this seriously. Or is this a legitimate expression of humility about, you know, where...
I'm saying that I can't do anymore, and you're going to have to do it.
Or it's been you all along. Verse 11, he says, I'm afraid. When a person finally gets to the point where I can say, I'm scared.
Yeah. Right.
I am... This is beyond me. I can't do this. I've been kidding myself maybe for 20 years.
Right.
I'm scared.
Isn't this a mark of maturity?
I think so. I think this prayer shows definitely shows spiritual growth in Jacob. He is absolutely honest. He's not holding back anything. He's absolutely honest, and he's also grateful. he understands, and again, this is a very, frank way of putting it. When I crossed the river the first time, all I had was my staff. Now I'm going back with all this. Thank you, God. And now, by the way, I'm terrified. Please come through on the promise. This is a very honest prayer. It's different, isn't it, than the kind of the bargaining that he did with God after the dream? You remember that back in 28? Jacob has this wonderful dream, and then he kind of bargains. All right, God, if you keep your promise, well, then I guess you can be my God.
But is this consistent with what's going to happen in the future when he wrestles with God to get a blessing?
You'll have to say more. What do you mean?
You're saying that he's being honest and authentic, and I'm a little bit on the cynical side, thinking he might be manipulating. And I see a consistency in his character that later on, when we read about him wrestling with God to get a blessing, he's basically trying to make sure he gets the blessing and God dislocates his hip or something. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying, I'm trying to look for a consistency. There's a saying that says, when you marry somebody when you're young, you think you're going to change them. And you then discover that you're not going to change that other person.
Yeah, but I think, don't we move back and forth between being frightened and humble and being egocentric? I mean, that's
Have you experienced that, Ruth?
Oh, yeah. There are times when you feel great confidence and pride, and then there are times when I'm on the ground saying, help.
One of the neat aspects of the storyteller here is that in the next story in the wrestling, of course, one of the results of it is that Jacob's name is changed, right? Then in the continuance of the story, wouldn't you expect the storyteller to use his new name?
Nope, he doesn't.
It goes back and forth. Sometimes it's Jacob, sometimes it's Israel. So you see, we don't ever, that simul justus et peccator thing.
That's right.
Saying sinner.
And who do we know him as? We don't know him as Israel. We know him as Jacob.
Okay.
We speak of him as Jacob. I mean, that's the name that we use mostly.
So the prayer,
the same way, Ruth was saying, I think he says he's undeserving, but then he says, but I have a right to expect that you'll keep your promise.
Yeah, okay, good.
I deserve that you keep your promise.
So this
even
is a
though
human
I'm undeserving.
Prayer. This is a human prayer.
They're both there.
Okay. So he sends a few animals as a gift, doesn't he, to Esau?
About
550. And he's pretty cagey about it. It's like Christmas Day.
Both male and female. It's clear. Male and female.
Oh, yeah. They're going to be productive. Yeah.
Yes.
And it's like, I think it's like Christmas morning. You get a few presents and you're like, boy, this has been great. And then, holy cow, there's another present there for me. So he sends them in stages.
Yep.
And after every one, the servant is to say, the giver of the gift is coming now. To his chief. So How are you describing Jacob's mood here, getting ready to meet up with Esau again?
He still does the same thing he did with Laban. He's very cagey about what he does.
He is very cagey.
He thinks ahead, and he, you know, divides them. And I mean, he's still doing his counting and trying to achieve.
Yes, he's terrified. He's terrified.
But he's doing his protection thing. You know. But you notice he also stays in the back. Once all the buttering up done.
He stays at the back after all the gifts.
Yeah.
Right. And so, okay, remember that tomorrow morning when we come to the real reconciliation. Okay, then here comes the climax of the story, verses 22 through 32. Who will read that? Someone please launch in.
The same night he got up and took his two wives, his two maids, and his 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabba. He took them and sent them across the stream, and likewise everything that he had. Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he struck him on the hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, "Let me go, for the day is breaking." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." Then the man said, "You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with humans and have prevailed." Then Jacob asked him, "Please tell me your name." But he said, "Why is it that you ask my name?" And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "For I have seen God face to face, and yet my life is preserved." The sun rose upon him as he passed Penuel, limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the Israelites do not eat the thigh muscle that is on the hip socket, because he struck Jacob on the hip socket at the thigh muscle.
Okay. Instead of just a totally open question, what strikes you, I'm going to direct this a little bit by asking, who is Jacob wrestling with?
A man.
A man. Mm-hmm. And actually, the word there in Hebrew is, it's the word ish, which is male. So it is a man. All right. Who is this man?
We understand it to be God, don't we?
Okay, how do we know that it is also, that wrestling with the man is also to wrestle with God?
For you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed.
All right, you have striven with God and with humans and have prevailed.
And the name that Jacob puts on the place is in Hebrew, face of God. Mm-hmm.
Right. For I have seen God face to face.
Face of God.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The sunrise, it has to... with the sun coming, being seen, and cannot see God and live.
Okay, right, mm-hmm. Right,
yeah.
Right. The sun is beginning to mm-hmm. dawn, and the man slash God says, "I gotta go."
Mm-hmm. I'm gotta go. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, is this the metaphor for his whole life, where he's been going back and forth between things?
Going back and forth between
God and himself, and man, and all of the things he's done. So, does it really have to be a man? It's a.
Okay, but that's actually really important what you're saying. I mean, one of the, I think, great questions about this is, why does the wrestling match happen now? Why didn't it happen right after he crossed the river to come, you know, leaving home? Why didn't it happen there?
He's gotten rid of all of his stuff.
Pardon me?
He's gotten rid of all of his stuff and his people and everything. He's by himself. Okay.
Again, yeah, isn't there, there's quite a... an effort made here to emphasize that he is alone.
Mm-hmm. But
he is completely alone. The same as right before his dream. He's completely alone. Completely and utterly alone. Okay?
He's vulnerable.
But he's vulnerable. In what sense is he vulnerable?
Well,
Well, he's alone and he's getting ready to face his brother.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Terrified. Mm-hmm. Terrified. Both of, you know, these dramatic encounters with God are serve as kind of bookends of Jacob's journey by himself, right? I mean, right at the beginning, he has this dream with God. It's the same vulnerability. I mean, Esau could be pursuing to kill him. And now at the end, vulnerable again, alone again, God drops in upon him. But there's a very, very dramatic difference between the dream and this encounter. Yes, Steve.
You know, I don't want to project too much on the story, but I just wonder, could he be, throughout his life at various times, could he start to doubt the blessing that he has and say, you know, I know I got the blessing, mm-hmm. but, you know, I did it the wrong way and I was through all this. And at these different times, he has to be reassured of that. And this would be a time when he would say, boy, this is really where he'll find out. Because maybe God really intended to bless Esau, and we manipulated, and my mom did this, and I did that. And now maybe God and Esau are marching together, and it's going to be...
Maybe God changed.
I mean, are the two of you, I'm hearing you essentially say, his whole life is passing before his face here.
Yeah.
You know, and he's struggling with his whole life. So who is Jacob wrestling with? It's a man, it's God, and it could be also
himself.
Himself. There's a fun literary little touch here in the story that, what is the name of the river?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we've got... this is kind of transliterating the Hebrew, but it's the river is look at that. And then the word in Hebrew to wrestle is so it's almost in a catchy kind of tricky way. The narrator is suggesting that Jacob is wrestling with himself here too. So yeah, I mean, this is...
At the deepest, darkest moments of our life, when we feel most alone, when we feel most vulnerable, all the world is crashing down around us, we often say we're wrestling with our demons inside.
Okay.
You know, those demons, what are they, you know, are they demons or are they all that stuff that's been eating away at us?
All those questions, Steve beautifully articulated some of the questions that Jacob must have had.
Mm-hmm. Partly Jacob got, actually, he got it wrong and God had to correct him. And in chapter 31, verse 3, he said, God says to Jacob, go back to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you. The promise is the presence of God. When Jacob does his prayer, he says, God, you said, go back to your country and your relatives, and I will make you prosper. But God didn't say that. He said, I will be with you. And when Jacob finally gets to that place where he's scared, and he says, okay, fulfill your promise, then Jacob wrestles with God. God is with him in a way that maybe he didn't expect or want. Maybe.
Interesting. Yeah, okay. Who is this God and what does God mean? What is the promise?
Mm-hmm. Isn't it kind of giving up everything? He is alone, and ultimately we are alone when we face God, in our deepest, as Cliff was talking about, in our biggest trial. I work as a chaplain in a nursing home, and those moments are blessings for me to be with people in that time when, they know that they've prevailed. In other words, they know that God is with them. And sometimes all it takes is just, don't fear, God is with you. Those are the words I use. So, very profound moment here for Jacob, because I think after this he's kind of through, and the forgiveness happens, and the reconciliation, everything, the prayer is answered.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's, you say, after this he's through. That, to me, is the answer of why does this happen now? Mm-hmm. This had to happen before he would be ready to reconcile with his brother. He could not be ready for that to happen without coming face to face with his demons, with what God intends, with what he's done, you know, all of that.
And we see in Jacob here is the affliction that's meted upon him in this wrestling match is a kind of a sign that we can take through continuing study all the way down to Paul with his affliction, that God's promises doesn't mean it's going to be a piece of cake from here on out. We still have to live with our personal afflictions, whether physical or emotional or psychological.
Yeah, okay, what kind of an image is this for life with God? It's an image of struggle. It's an image of struggle, of wrestling. Yeah.
There's a rabbi in Seattle, Anson Leitner, who wrote a book called Wrestling with God. And he contends that this story is at the heart of one of the most important Jewish traditions of their faith. And he points to many other stories, but the idea of going to God face to face, fighting it out, you know, at many points in our lives is mm-hmm. what we are encouraged to do, not the kind of piety that says, oh God, you know best, you know, I'll just do whatever you want. And one of the examples would be the Psalms of Lament.
Right.
People just go and put it right in God's face. This is what you said you'd do. And,
yeah, the question that I raised is kind of a title for this session is, why did God wrestle with Jacob rather than hold a polite conversation? Yeah, I mean, we find that the relationship, our relationship with God is not always polite. And God initiates this, not Jacob. God initiates, God drops in on
it. And he puts, God put the finger on the socket and threw his leg out of the joint.
We'll hold on to that for a minute. Yep.
I've heard Pastor Serpin wants to use the word nestle in opposition to wrestle. And some people choose to nestle with God, and they don't want to face the hard work and just, you know,
like preach it. Yeah. Whoa. No, that's great. That was a good preaching.
This may be a tangent, but this is setting up that we are called to wrestle with God before reconciling with our brother. And I think that somehow I'm hearing the words of Jesus, you must reconcile with your brother before you come to the God at the Eucharist. Is that right? Am I remembering this? I'm not. And so this is kind of a tension between the Old Covenant and the New Covenant.
Well, I'm not sure that it is.
Okay.
I'm not sure that it is. Because what's the end of the story? We're moving always toward reconciliation. So that is clear. This is not the end of the story. Reconciliation is the end of the story. And if I'm right, this is necessary in order to prepare Jacob to properly reconcile with his brother. So the goal is always reconciliation.
And I think we always have to wrestle with ourselves before we can be reconciled. When there's been a conflict with someone, we have to wrestle with our own part in that and our own stubbornness and our, before we can be reconciled.
And when you wrestle at the deepest, you not only recognize how you've been wounded, but how you've wounded others.
Right. That's what I mean. We have to reconcile with our own stubbornness and our own way that we've inflicted pain and our own pride and self-centeredness.
But you can't wrestle. I don't know that you can't. Can you wrestle with yourself without God being right there with you?
Certainly, my friends wrestle.
I don't know, that's not this story.
I guess I just sort of was thinking about how sort of Jacob's life has been training as a wrestler. Okay, he wrestles in the womb with Esau. Wrestles with Esau.
Yes, absolutely.
For the birthright, the blessing. Then he wrestles with Laban for, you know, gets back to the, you strip, basically wrestle with Manning. God. Yeah. And it's all building up to this final wrestling match here.
That's right.
That's great.
That's right. His whole life has been a wrestling from the womb forward. That's right. And now an important thing to notice here is what is God's verdict upon that life of wrestling from the womb forward? Is God here in a place of saying, all right, Jacob, finally I've got you now, and I'm going to show you how wrong you've been, the life you've lived has been a horrible life, and you've taken advantage of everyone on it?
No, I think he gives him a blessing, but he does touch him to remind him that we've had this discussion.
Okay. And it's, of course, it's not a discussion. But notice this. Yeah, let's refer then to Steve's point. In verse 28, then the man said, you shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with humans, and you've been a total idiot and jerk all along. wait a minute. No, he doesn't actually say that. You have striven with God and with humans and have prevailed.
You've lived to tell the story.
Yeah, you've lived to tell the story. You've succeeded. You've come through it all.
In this translation, you have won.
You have won.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so this is not a note of judgment or of scolding. It's a note of affirmation. And isn't that beautiful and gracious? Wow. I mean, through all the messiness of this story and all the mixed motives, you know, and out deception, you know, nevertheless, Jacob, you've come through it all, and here we are together.
It's like you passed the test.
Well, okay.
So that you can become Israel.
Mm-hmm. That's right. The father of a nation.
Wow.
You mentioned Jacob being other words, taking the letters and rearranging them. It dawned on me that Jacob is a five-letter word starting with J. And there's another five-letter word starting with J. Oh. Jesus.
Okay.
I don't know if that's the...
I do. The story that actually came up for me is Genesis chapter 3, the fall. What happens is they eat of the fruit and then they hide. And God walks out into the garden and they hide from God. And God's act of restoring God's people is to be able to come face to face, to wrestle. You know, when I get to wrestle with my son, that is joy for me. That is playful. That is intimacy. That is relationship. And here, do we get to see God finally gets to wrestle, God gets to romp and play with his child again. And this is a glimpse of the restoration and the redemption that God is at work from Genesis chapter 3. It's a glimpse of what God is doing in salvation history. And I just delight in that. I want to wrestle with my Heavenly Father and look him face to face, you know, kind of out of breath with him pinning me down. Let me up, please, Dad. And then he gives me a little whack to say, remember that. But
Except that when you wrestle with your son, I assume you don't throw his...
No, but I'm, you know, when he punches me in the gut, and every once in a while I'll punch him back just to remind him, you know, don't, you know, this is play, but I'm still stronger than you. You still have a little more ways to go. Lo, I am with you always, you know. And let this be a little reminder, you know.
Picking up on that, is this stretching it too far, but as you were talking about with your...
Oh, I think I stretched it about as far as anyone.
Okay. I'm just wondering, is this a glimpse of... a foretaste of incarnational theology at all, because God appears as a man, and it's, you know, it's flesh to flesh. It's
the face of God.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Very cool. Sure.
Yeah.
So I think, in other words, the first encounter was a dream. Okay, that's a non-physical encounter, and here the final encounter is this. I would say loving. Wrestling match. It's a challenging wrestling match too, but it's an incarnate promise. It's an incarnation of the promise, right here. Okay, so here's where we're going to go. We haven't finished with this story. Well, we're not going to finish with it, I don't think about it. We're going to say more about it tomorrow. We're going to talk about the new name a little bit and about the blessing, what the blessing is, and about this limp. Jacob limps away. What is that all about? And finally, then return to this image of a physical struggle as an image for our relationship with God. What kind of an image is that? And then we're going to get to the scene of reconciliation with Esau, because that has a lot to teach us, too. So this has been very rich for me today. Thanks for sharing. Thank you. Very profound. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.